Hello and welcome to Ukraine Calling, your weekly review of what's been happening in Ukraine with a focus on a main issue. I'm Oksana Smerichuk for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here's a look at some of the stories that were in the news this week.
The U.S. Senate on Thursday voting to turn the screws on Russia with new sanctions, a slap to President Trump as he tries to step up relations with the Kremlin.
It's hugely important because now it's the border between us and the European Union states is just the border and not a barrier. And that I think is the biggest change and positive change.
Прощай, немитая Россия. Бо ми з вами, український народ і вся Україна, вступаємо в іншу історичну епоху. І ця подія знаменує остаточний розрив з Російською імперією.
Last week saw a deterioration of the security situation. The SMM recorded a 75% increase in the number of ceasefire violations compared to the previous week. The SMM recorded over 1,200 explosions caused by mortars, tanks and artillery, including multiple launch rocket systems. There were 191 such explosions recorded by the SMM the previous week.
In a case Amnesty International's denounced as a travesty of justice, the head of Russia's only state-run Ukrainian library has been convicted of inciting hatred against Russians. Natalia Sharina, who's been held under house arrest, denied wrongdoing, but a Moscow court gave her a 4-year suspended jail term, despite staff testifying that books deemed anti-Russian propaganda were planted in the library by police.
Good news. A good spring for Ukraine was a headline in Canada's newspaper, The National Post, recently. Diane Francis listed all the positive developments in Ukraine in recent months. She's one of the paper's editors and also a fellow at the Atlantic Council and distinguished professor at Toronto's Ryerson University. The week definitely began on a positive note. At midnight on Sunday, June the 11th, the EU's borders opened to Ukrainians for visa-free travel. The country's president, Petro Poroshenko, called the moment a final break with the Russian Empire. Standing in front of a crowd in Kyiv's European Square, he called it a historic moment. And then, with a smile on his face and a little wave, he quoted the 19th century Russian poet Mikhail Lermontov saying, "Farewell, unwashed Russia." We'll post a video of the speech and the wave on our website. And later in the show, we'll bring you a feature interview with Ukraine's Vice Premier for European and Euro-Atlantic Integration, Ivana Klempush-Tsintsadze, with her viewpoint on this event. It will be followed by some more reflections on visa-free travel and being accepted by writer Katerina Babkina. Not good news. But Russia continues to wage war against Ukraine in many ways. In Moscow, a court convicted former head of the Ukrainian library, Natalia Sharina, of extremism and embezzlement and gave the librarian a 4-year suspended sentence. She had been charged back in 2015 for having books in storage which incited inter-ethnic enmity and hatred. Sharina's defense lawyer said the incriminating books were planted by police. BBC reported that Ms. Sharina plans to appeal the court's decision and that after the trial she said that a librarian is such a good, peaceful profession. You sit there reading books. So the fact that this is happening in the 21st century will probably be remembered in decades to come, like we remember the Doctor's Plot and 1937, referring to the Stalin era. Amnesty International called the case a travesty of justice. In Kyiv last Friday, an assassin posed as a journalist and tried to kill Amina Okuyeva and her husband. She's a minor celebrity in Ukraine. A Chechen medical doctor who studied in Odessa was active in the Euromaidan. Then when war broke out in eastern Ukraine, she headed to the front. Last week, a man masquerading as a journalist from Le Monde tried to assassinate her and her husband. She pulled out her own gun and defended herself and helped reveal that the alleged journalist was actually a Chechen assassin, purportedly sent by the Kremlin. And a real journalist has gone missing in Donetsk. Former MP and Donetsk Automaidan activist Yehor Firsov notified Ukrainian authorities about the disappearance. The Ukrainian journalist has lived in Donetsk since the occupation and has been writing under the pseudonym Stanislav Vasin for Ukrainian and international media outlets, including Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. According to his relatives, the man failed to show up for a meeting in Avdiivka on the 2nd of June, and his apartment in Donetsk has signs of a break-in. The Ukraine Crisis Media Center reported that authorities of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic did not provide any information about the journalist's whereabouts. The past week was bloody and deadly in the war zone in eastern Ukraine. OSCE reported a 75% increase in explosions. Civilians continued to be targets. Ukrainian authorities reported that the town of Avdiivka was left without gas supplies when their infrastructure was bombed. Over the past week, 9 Ukrainian soldiers were killed and 41 sustained injuries. The United Nations mission in Ukraine expressed concern that things would continue to escalate with the warmer weather arriving, since this has been the pattern of the war for the past 3 years. Meanwhile, back in the US, Congress voted almost unanimously for new sanctions against Russia, targeting energy, mining, metals, and railways, and individuals involved in cyber attacks or weapons procurement to the Syrian government. This comes the same week as Trump and his allies are under the microscope for alleged collaboration with the Kremlin during the 2016 election campaign. Congress also voted to limit President Trump's ability to ease any existing sanctions against Russia that were imposed during the Obama presidency. Today, we will be talking about the process of European integration and how this has allowed Ukrainians to see visa-free travel. We are having a conversation with Ivana Klempush-Tsintsadze, Ukraine's Vice Premier for European and Euro-Atlantic Integration. Welcome.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Just to recap recent events, last Sunday, June the 11th, was a rather special day from a Ukrainian perspective. The European Union's decision to allow visa-free travel came into force from midnight, which means that Ukrainians can now travel up to 90 days in the Schengen area without a visa, just with a Ukrainian biometric passport. There was a big celebration in central Kyiv on European Square with a countdown to midnight. An emotional speech to the crowds by President Poroshenko, who said that Ukraine was saying a final farewell to the Soviet and Russian Empire. So how did you spend the first day of visa-free travel?
Well, started really early by seeing off one of the first trains that was carrying passengers with biometric passports that were trying to double check how it works. It was a train Kyiv-Przemyśl, going from Kyiv to Poland, and we had a big delegation of about 40 experts, activists, civil society leaders, some of the very well-known writers as well as, for example, Andrei Kurkov, who gathered together because they have, over these years, they have really made a serious effort to help the government and the state to carry out those reform efforts that have led to this decision of the European Union. So, and they traveled and celebrated then in Przemyśl on Polish territory this particular day. I had to stay back home because next day I had to go to another trip to double check how does it work on the visit with Prime Minister Groysman to Croatia, where we also had the possibility to see the confirmation and also to celebrate along with our partners that historic decision. I totally agree that this is a historic decision because it takes away those barriers that have been formed over Soviet times, and then later after the after the end of the Cold War, after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, between Ukraine and our neighbors who have joined the European Union and who have succeeded much faster in their reform process and in their acceptance to the European Union. So I think it's hugely important, because now it's the border between us and the European Union states is just the border and not a barrier. And that I think is the biggest change and positive change, both for youngest representatives of the Ukrainian society, who are, I'm sure, going to use all the opportunities it presents of exploring Europe, bringing in experience from Europe to Ukraine, and obviously also for those who are more mature but have never had the chance to travel.
However, in the past 2 years leading up to this day of visa-free, it's been something of a roller coaster ride for Ukrainians. President Poroshenko promised EU visa-free travel, that it was coming soon to Ukraine early in his presidency. And Ukrainians were waiting with high expectations. Then had some disappointment that it wasn't happening right away. For example, in April of last year, Ukrainians were following events in the Netherlands with high interest, as there in the Netherlands, voters in a referendum rejected an agreement that would bring closer economic ties between Ukraine and the EU. So disappointment. But then just now in May, the Netherlands Parliament did vote in the amended agreement, so relief. But still in the public mood, there was a lot of skepticism and incredulity that the visa-free regime would ever come into effect. So why do you think there's this intense interest in the issue of visa-free travel, namely to Europe? What does it mean for the average Ukrainian?
Well, first and foremost, we have to understand that Ukraine has found itself in the middle of basically internal European discussions, when it was a discussion between Eurosceptics and Eurocentrics, if I may. Also in the Netherlands, when this referendum on the association agreement ratification was taking place a year ago. And we have been assured by quite a lot of our partners from abroad that this unfortunately had nothing to do with Ukraine. It was more about the capability of Europeans to cope with their internal challenges, with the migration wave that was experienced by European Union states in 2015. Which Ukraine did not contribute to at all, notwithstanding the fact that we do have the part of our territory occupied by Russian Federation, illegally annexed by Russian Federation, and we have more than 1,700,000 of internally displaced people who did not go to find their home, so to say, in the European Union states, but have resettled in the other territories, in the other regions of Ukraine. So it's important to understand that unfortunately it was just a bad timing for us to deliver on our part of the promise and on our internal changes. Why it was so important, and why is it so important for Ukrainian population and for Ukrainian citizens that visa-free travel is now has now become possible? Because this is about two major things. That means that the country is changing in accordance to the desire and will of people that has been chosen during the Revolution of Dignity back in 2013-2014, when we actually fought for association agreement to be signed, because then authorities have decided to take the wrong and totally unsupported move of keeping out from the association agreement. So from then on, it was a return of the Ukrainian citizens to their roots and to their home as Europe has been always home for Ukrainians, as Ukraine has always been a European country. So for us, it's about our dignity. It's about being seen as partners, being seen as equals that we believe we are, and that we can also contribute a lot to the future of the European continent, bringing in this value of protection of those basic freedoms that are important for every single European citizen. And so that's why we believe that we are also entitled to this chance and to this possibility to further implement laws, procedures, rules that have proven their ability to upbring the nations, to develop nations in on the European continent back to Ukraine as well.
Now, what about for Ukrainians who do not want to travel? How does this association agreement bring Europe to them?
Let me just also return back just a little bit to the previous question, because there is also a lot of manipulation and a lot of attempts to present as if it's not important for any Ukrainian because not all of us have the financial capacity to travel. But I think we are underestimating the desire of Ukrainians to learn more about the world and to also present themselves and with all the additional opportunities traveling by bus, by train, that are not that expensive as plane travel, for example. I'm sure that a lot of people will explore this opportunity. With regard to those who still will decide not to travel, association agreement is a clear and very ambitious, very difficult, we have to understand that, set of reforms that we have accepted as our guidance for change here in accordance to the rules that are common for the European Union states. And therefore, with bringing different spheres of our lives to the standards that are operational in the European Union, we will make sure that Ukrainians are getting kind of a stamp of quality, of upgraded quality of life here, and upgraded possibilities for not only visa-free for people, but at some point, I could say about visa-free for our products, for our capital, for services, and we will be able to act on the same basis as other companies and legal bodies are operating in the European Union states. So therefore, it's about every single standard, starting from the environmental protection and to the safety of products that are being sold on our in our stores.
Mm-hmm. So just last week, the Ukrainian Parliament adopted amendments which confirm that Ukraine's foreign policy objective is now joining NATO. So how realistic do you think is that prospect?
Well, first and foremost, I'm very much welcoming this decision of the Ukrainian Parliament, because ambiguity and not decidedness in this direction has actually led Russian Federation to believe that it can attack Ukraine and paved basically the way for Russian occupation of the Ukrainian territories. So clarity of the goal and thus importance of every single step of reaching to that goal by setting internally the standards that are common for NATO states, both in the Ukrainian defense and security system, but much wider in the, you know, in terms of ensuring the work of the rule of law, ensuring the democracy standards or the freedom of speech for that matter, or any other, which is common for NATO nations. This is just part of the same important job. It's the same direction, the EU integration, European integration, Euro-Atlantic integration. So we are not putting a question forward today that we want to submit a membership, I don't know, how do you call it? Membership application. But it's about knowing the goal, setting a clear timetable for ourselves. How can we ensure that within the system of defense or within this system of security, we are following both technical and procedural and political standards of operation, starting from the civilian control over armed forces or over military or over security architecture in the country and up to a very specific technical requirements to that type of ammunition that we are using in our army, for example. And that, again, requires a lot of internal work. So I think that it's a realistic perspective once we are ready.
In all the excited interest in the lead-up to visa-free travel to the EU on the 11th of June, it was easy to overlook the fact that just a week ago, the Cabinet of Ministers ratified establishing an Office for Gender Issues. As Vice Premier, you had been assigned responsibility for the portfolio of gender issues. And this is significant, and it's also a first for Ukraine that these issues have been given such a high profile. So what are you going to do? What are you going to do next?
Well, first and foremost, I think it's extremely important that gender equality issue is a matter that is uniting the whole government and that it is high on the agenda of the government, and it is reflected in our three-year plan that we have recently, a plan of action that we have recently adopted for the government. And I think this means that the gender equality will have to be a part of activities and part of practice in different ministries. It's a longer road. We have some successes already on this way, but still, I think we are still pretty much at the beginning of efficient implementation phase. I'm very happy that ministers and prime minister have supported the establishment of the governmental envoy position in the government, which is important for the establishment of practice of interagency coordination among the ministries, because we do have a separate Ministry of Social Policy, that is responsible for producing a gender policy and setting the agenda. But then it's very difficult to coordinate horizontally between the ministries their activities. And that's why you need some of the kind of upper coordination role to assemble all the initiatives and to ensure and to control and monitor how the things that we've set for ourselves are being implemented. And then you are creating the positive force of pushing and making sure that we are actually delivering on those plans that we have adopted for ourselves, because we do have a very good developed national action plan for implementation of the UN Resolution 1325, for example, on women, peace and security. But then again, it's very difficult to ensure that it's being delivered in a coordinated and coherent way by different ministries, and that everybody is up to speed on implementation, that one. Or with regard to the plan of ensuring the equal human rights, which also has a separate section on ensuring gender equality, for example. So this just gives you the instrument, gives the government the instrument how to coordinate more efficiently and how to monitor and create additional new system of monitoring, which is, again, more adequate to the today's challenges and up to modern requirements as well. And here we are lucky that we have international partners of ours happy to help in implementation, and we are grateful for our Swedish government, for Canadian government for supporting these efforts, and also for UN Women, for OECD on the spot here, so all the international organizations, Council of Europe as well, all the international organizations that also value the importance of this matter. So I hope that with these very concrete steps, we will be able to deliver more on equality of women.
You have said doing away with gender stereotypes is far from easy. In a way, it is a farewell to the colonial inheritance. This is not about women's issues themselves, but issues of stability and security for the development of society and the state. What do you mean by that?
Unfortunately, our society is not yet well aware of the fact that by empowering women, we are empowering the even economic well-being of the society. By having women more engaged in decision-making on the higher level, we are creating a more sustainable formula of delivering on for example, this even peace process, because that means that you are looking at the problem from totally different perspective, from male and female perspective, and then you are creating a much more encompassing way of dealing with the problem, including the setting of peace, or including the reintegration of territories, including the reintegration of people, for example. Also, we are not well aware of the statistics that is speaking very valuably to the success of different countries when more engagement of women in politics, in social life, in active role in the society has produced a clear positive trend in GDP growth, in ensuring the well-being of people, and this is something that is totally underestimated in the society here. Also, we did have it years ago, or centuries rather ago, we had a society where men and women were standing on a much more equal footing. Unfortunately, with the presence of the Russian Empire on our territory, and then the Soviet state on our territory, we have lost quite a lot of those traditions. So we are coming back to very old tradition of the Ukrainian society. And we can see that even right now in the parliament, we have 12% of women. It's still a very low representation percentage, but it's the highest we've ever had. And we can see how efficiently and actively women are using this mandate that they received in representing people in the parliament, and someone probably even can think that there are more women than only 12% in the Ukrainian parliament, because they are so engaged and so active and so caring for every single issue that they are dealing with. So I think I would like to see us at some point having at least 150 mandates, so one third of the Ukrainian parliament being represented by women, professional, highly skilled women that are capable of taking care of the tasks that are set by before parliamentarians. And also it would be good to have more representation of women in the Ukrainian government. At this point, we have, if you take percentage-wise, you will have 8% of women in the government. But if you think of the whole civil service, public service, then 75% of women are working in civil service. So this is total underrepresentation. On the basic ground level, you have most of women working, and then once it comes to the decision making, then there are only few. I think this balance has to be just brought to adequate of representing the society.
You have been listening to a conversation with Ivana Klempusz-Tsintsadze, Vice Premier for European and Euro-Atlantic Integration. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you. It's been a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
This week, we will be sharing some writing inspired by the start of visa-free travel to the EU. The writer and poet Katerina Babkina wrote on what this change means to Ukrainians. The essay is called "They Accepted Us." Here is an excerpt. "And with my passports, it's all different. These are my little fetishes. They have lots of visas and stamps. 3 and 5 year European multiple entry visas. USA and Canada for 10 years. For a full house, I guess I'm lacking visas to Great Britain and Australia. But for the time being, I don't need to go there. There are also various strange Asian visas. Some of those I received through sustained correspondence with various Asian ministries over several months. Others through bank confirmations of having certain sums of money with which you'd be able to live for a couple of years in the country of destination. Without this amount, they will not stick the coloured piece of paper in your passport. Your passport gets full from all the stamps and visas considerably faster than its actual expiry date, and I acquire new passports and I cut the visas out of the old ones. I have a whole box full of these visas. My passports are like my school diary, where the marks are all excellent and good. It's like a report card that says you are the third, no, maybe the fifth best in your class. I always offer them proudly and ceremoniously to the passport officers at passport control. Let them see how many places I have visited. Let them know how many countries have regarded me as worthy of granting me admission. I was once invited to a cinema festival in New York in order to do a poetry reading. I came to the embassy with my splendid passport, which gave evidence of how many places I had travelled to successfully and legally and from which I returned. And with 100% genuine invitations, with stamps and signatures, from Columbia University and from the cinema festival. It took the visa officer at the window all of 40 seconds to tell me to go home. Maybe he had a toothache. Perhaps the festival had not published the full program yet, and they didn't see my name in my photo, which appeared later. Maybe they had issued too many visas that day. I will never know. After that incident, which happened and was forgotten about quite long ago, I changed my attitude to people who had decided not to travel anywhere. Because they had a blank passport. Because they had no reference from work. Because they didn't know how to fill in the form. Because they were afraid that they had the wrong tickets and not the right sort of hotel bookings. Because they wanted to visit relatives or friends, and that was suspect. Because they were unmarried. Because they thought that everybody in the consulate would be speaking to them in a foreign language which they don't understand. And in the visa centre they won't let them in because there will be a problem in going through the metal detector. Or the security guard won't like their face. But actually, it's simply because they don't want to be not admitted. They don't want to be told and possibly have this confirmed with a document that they are worse than they should be. That they're not the sort of people that we want to see. That they are not suitable. I remembered this expedition to the American consulate and the attempts of people to avoid similar adventures, whether consciously or unconsciously. It seemed quite rational to me. Held up against the background of this negative emotional experience, the opportunity to explore and learn, investigate a new reality, and broaden one's worldview did not seem enough of a motivation to trouble oneself in order to obtain a sticker in one's passport. Visa-free travel to the EU actually does not take away our borders and limitations. Tickets and hotels are still expensive. The proof that you will return and the proof that you have the means to pay for your stay in your destination country can still be needed. And foreign languages have not become any more comprehensible. But you do not have to prove to anyone in advance that you are okay, and that is very important. According to published data, on the first day of visa-free travel, 52,000 people left Ukraine for the Schengen zone countries, and only 20% of them were really without visas and with those scary, blank, absolutely new passports. But the number of people in visa centres indicates that soon everybody will have those blank new passports, and they will be proud of them. that is, of the passports of their own country, and not what the consulates of other countries have decided to glue in them. I flew out of Boryspil that same Sunday morning, and it seemed to me that all 52,000 of those people were there. Approximately half of them held balloons, and absolutely all of them were happy, because they were admitted. We were all admitted. They gave us a good mark. They told us that we were no worse than anybody else. And this inspires and stimulates and takes away our fear and our stress. Takes away those stones which build the scariest and most insurmountable borders inside of us. In case you were wondering if there's a country sound in Ukrainian music, check out this number by a band called Nebraska from Drohobych, Ivano-Frankivsk in western Ukraine. It's called Ey brate, vse v nas dobre bude. It means, hey brother, all's going to be fine with us. In July, they'll be performing live at a music festival in a town called Dubno, which is in the Rivne Oblast. The festival is called Taras Bulba. He was a legendary Ukrainian Cossack leader. Some of you might remember the 1962 Hollywood film about him starring Yul Brynner and Tony Curtis, loosely based on the novel by Nikolai Gogol, or in Ukrainian, Mykola Hohol. But back to Nebraska. Here is Hey Brother. Enjoy.
Так і не навчився грати, і не пізнав секретів гри. Чомусь доводиться завжди нам обирати, мати все чи порожнім іти. Складнювати речі, такі прості, як світлі дні. Я відмовляюсь будувати велике щастя на малі брехні. Знати чисті очі у світлі душі. Не треба нічого вже казати,
Next week, Bohdan Mihailo will be hosting the show and bringing you an overview of the news in Ukraine, international issues, and a feature interview. Tune in for a new episode, and we'd love to hear from you. Write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. I'm Oksana Smerechuk for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. Thanks for listening.